Go. Okay. It's live.
Thank you. Hello, I'm calling this meeting to order. This is the House Interim Committee on Revenue on Friday, December 18th. We have four items on our agenda. The first item could take just a minute or two. Before we get to that, I'd like to take attendance, please. Someone please call the roll.
Okay, Chair Nathanson?
Here.
Vice Chair Marsh?
Here, by Thea.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Good afternoon. Representative Reschke is here by video.
Okay, Representative Kenny Geyer?
Here by video.
Representative Lauren Spence?
Present by video.
Representative Owens?
Good afternoon, here by video.
And Representative Greg Smith?
Representative Smith is present by telephone.
The first item on our agenda is I wanted to make a short statement for everybody so that we all just heard the same thing at the same time. Yesterday, I wrote a message to the committee with recalling what we had discussed, that there will be no committee bills this time because of House rules that require us to be present to vote. So there will be no committee bills. And then when I realized there were going to be a couple dozen, more than a couple dozen bills, all of a sudden with my name on them, that looked like I individually asked for all these ideas, I thought, well, that really doesn't mirror usual process, what's typical for a committee. So I had a chat with the chief clerk of the House. I had a chat with Chris Alanak and Corinne in Legislative Revenue Office. And so what we've done is we have posted a list of, I believe it's 31 draft LCs that I will submit individually because that's the process that we need to use this year. However, these aren't like all my terrific individual ideas. Most of these, as you got to see on the list, are either something that's more or less standard operating procedure that we have bills ready because there were tax credits that were due to sunset, for example, or the tax revisers bill. A lot of these were standard operating procedure that normally every time a session comes around like this, these bills are ready and we do them. There are also several bills in the list for things that were in the works in the previous session. They just didn't get all the way through the process. So we just had them redrafted in the form they were in when they were left on the table. So my invitation to you is if there are some of these that you would like to sign on to as a committee member to be either a co-chief sponsor or just simply a co-sponsor, I'm going to have all of those LC drafts in the Legislative Revenue Office on Monday, and you can just go down and sign one or two or three or none or some, whatever you like. But those will be available for the whole committee to sign on to. So are there any questions about that? And you'll find them posted on OLIS. Everybody will be able to see them now. And that actually mirrors typical process. If it was a different year and we were considering them for committee bills, we would have posted them all on OLIS for today's meeting. Okay. That's it. We're maybe 3 minutes ahead of our anticipated schedule, but that's just fine. Do we have the people with us that we should have for the next item on the agenda?
Yes, we do, Madam Chair.
Great. The next item is a report on Oregon state and local business taxes. Mr. Alanak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, OBI, Oregon Business and Industry, recently commissioned a report on business tax burdens from the State Tax Research Institute. And Scott Brune is here from from OBI to introduce that and lead into the presentation. So I'll hand it over to him.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. Really appreciate this opportunity and good afternoon. My name is Scott Bruin. I am the new Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for OBI Oregon Business and Industry, and it is really my pleasure to be here today. If I may, I'd like to introduce my my partners for today's presentation. First, is Carolyn Salee. She is an economist and senior manager for Ernst & Young out of their San Francisco-based office. Next is Doug Lindholm. I see Doug. Doug is president and executive director of COSTS, that's the Council of State Taxation, and he's based in Washington, D.C. And then I know she's out there. My colleague, Nikki DeBay. Nikki is a tax partner and practitioner here in Portland with Eversheds and Sutherland. Today, as Chris said, we are presenting a study that we actually concluded back in October, and then we revised in November following the November elections. The study comes from the study really stems from work that all of you have seen in the past, because it is that it's the work done by Ernst & Young in partnership with the State Tax Research Institute, where they compare the level and the burden of business taxation among all 50 states. This study is unique in that that we're presenting today, and then in that it is titled, it flows from that, but it goes farther for us, and it's called the Oregon State. It's titled the Oregon State and Local Tax Burdens, and it is available. It's meaty, so it is available on OLIS for everybody to see and read when they have the time. Without giving away too much of the bottom line, let me just say that the study is sobering, and basically how far and how fast the business tax burden in Oregon has changed, and what that might mean for our ability to attract the new investments, which leads to new jobs. And we will get much deeper into that as we do this presentation today, but just wanted to kind of kick it off with that. And with that, let me turn it over to Doug, who's going to get us started.
Great. Thank you, Scott. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It is an honor to be with you today. My name is Doug Lindholm. As Scott indicated, I'm the president and executive director of COSTS, the Council on State Taxation, which represents primarily the Fortune 1000 on state tax issues. I'm also the president of the State Tax Research Institute, which is the 501c3 foundation organized under COSTS. Scott referenced the business tax burden study, and let me give you some background on that, because the study has been released annually for 20 years now, and it was commissioned initially with the folks at EY, their Quantitative Economics and Statistics Group, because we were hearing constantly, whenever there's a business proposal, we were hearing supporters and sponsors saying, we just want to make sure businesses are paying their fair share. Well, and that's a fine sentiment, but it begs two questions, and that is, how much are businesses actually paying in their total tax burden? Because states, localities, municipalities levy a whole host of taxes on businesses operating within their borders. Secondly, it begs the question of how much is a fair share? So we set out to answer both of those questions to give legislators a guide for whether the tax proposals or the total tax burden in a state was a legitimate tax burden. Some really interesting findings came out of that. First was that businesses pay about 44% of all state and local taxes. And that number has been remarkably constant over the 20 years that we have done the study, within 1% of 44% over the last 20 years. So that is one factor. And when you combine all the taxes, property taxes, sales taxes on business inputs, franchise taxes, corporate activity taxes, all the taxes that are business bound, then it was a number that had never really been calculated before, because so even business taxes are paid through the personal income tax for pass-through entities, limited liability companies, et cetera. The study that Caroline is going to present to you today is based on the business tax burden study. And the burden study looks at two things. One, what is the total burden? But there's also a calculation in there that, if you haven't seen it, about what are the benefits that businesses derive from the revenues they pay, and are businesses paying for the benefits that they receive from the state. So one of the more interesting aspects of the OBI report, when we took a look just at the tax increases in Oregon on Oregon businesses over the last 2 years, those tax increases have risen by 41%. Now, that's a significant jump, and it's I have not seen a jump of that significance in the 20 years that we've been seeing the study. Now, Oregon had a little bit of a skewed result from business taxes, because obviously you don't impose a sales tax. The sales tax, average sales taxes in states impose those sales taxes on about 41% of business inputs, not on final consumption, which is what the sales tax is supposed to be levied upon, but upon business inputs. So without that, the Oregon burden was low, but it doesn't mean that the specific taxes on businesses were low from a comparative standpoint. And that was a very interesting finding. And I will turn it over to Caroline to walk you through the report. And, we're happy to take questions at any time. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Doug. Hi, everyone. As Scott and Doug mentioned, I'm Caroline Salee. I'm a senior manager in EY's Quantitative Economics and Statistics Practice. And I have had the privilege of working on the tax burden study that we do with COST for the past 8 years. So I'm excited to present some of the work that we did specifically for Oregon. I know we have a PowerPoint. So is that going to be pulled up? Perfect. Okay, excellent. Can we go to the next slide, please? So I'm going to start first with a few comments about the study and what we did. So we looked at four recent state tax changes. We then looked at three enacted local tax changes in the Portland metro area and at five ballot initiatives. So as Scott mentioned, we started our work over the summer and we looked at the five ballot initiatives affecting business, four of which passed. So this results that I'm going to be presenting today include the ones that have passed. So from a high level, those are the taxes we included in our analysis. And then our analysis really did three things. So first, we looked at the impact on business and estimated the level of taxes once all the taxes are fully phased in. And that's important because there is a timing issue around some of the taxes, particularly in the state tax side, the paid family medical leave tax funded through a payroll tax, which does not go into effect until 2022. So that's the first point I want to make. We did an analysis with all the taxes fully phased in. Second, we estimated tax payments by business in fiscal year 19. So on that base of economic activity, and we did that so that we could compare what would be the new taxes and the new tax burdens imposed on business compared to the current baseline, which is fiscal 19 data. And that was the most recent data that we had on a comprehensive basis. So that's the second point I want to make. The third point is that this study looks at taxes as a share of economic activity measured by GDP. So when I refer to, tax burden or total effective business tax rate, or TABER for short, when I'm saying effective tax rate, I am meaning business taxes divided by the appropriate GDP. So I just want to make that clear. So let me just tell you what our findings are at a high level first. So on the state tax side, as Doug mentioned, our first finding is that we found the four new state tax changes lead to a pretty substantial increase in state business tax burdens. So we estimate a $1.8 billion increase, once those taxes are fully phased in, for a 41% increase in business taxes compared to that fiscal 19 baseline. So the second finding is that tax burden change means that the state's effective tax rate goes from 2% of economic activity to 2.8%, so reflecting that 40% increase. Third, we looked at how does Oregon then compare once these taxes are phased in, how would Oregon then rank against the other states with their state taxes? And because we do this work every year with cost, we have that data available. So we could compare Oregon current state to sort of the new state with the new taxes. And we found that Oregon would go from being one of the 10 lowest state tax burden states, for reasons Doug mentioned, the lack of a sales tax, to the 19th highest. So it jumps above sort of the state average and really makes a substantial change in those rankings. And then finally, the fourth finding is that we obviously COVID right now is disrupting revenue for state and local governments. So we looked at, well, what is going to happen to state tax revenues in the next few years due to COVID? And so we used some of the reports put out by the state government, some of the forecasting numbers to sort of basically project what would the world look like in fiscal year 22, which taxes would go up, which would go down, and see if our results still hold in this COVID world. And we found that when we did all of the modeling of the different taxes, we felt like our results were still applicable. So do you want to note that? On the local side, we then modeled what is the change in tax burden for Portland metro area businesses. As I mentioned, we ended up looking at seven tax changes that affect businesses at the city, the county, and the metro level. And the impact of those business taxes once fully phased in was a 23% tax increase for just on the local side for Portland area businesses. And that means that their total effective tax rate affecting local businesses in Oregon would increase from 1.8% of economic activity to 2%. And that is actually the statewide local effective tax rate. So we added, you know, what is the new taxes in the Portland area affecting those businesses? We added it to our number for local business taxes in the entire state and then calculated that effective rate. So that's not just a Portland area measure, it's a statewide measure, which again we did so we could compare to local taxes in other states, which we calculate with our cost study. And then finally, the last finding on this slide is that Oregon total TABOR increases from 3.8% to 4.8%. So we've added the state and local taxes together. We've taken it, divided it by statewide GDP, and that is that increase when you take both sides. And I think that there is a question. Should I pause for a moment? Or did I not have that right?
This is Pam Marsh. I do have a question. Rep Nathanson, okay. Is that appropriate?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see the hand up if there was. Sorry.
Thank you. I just have a question about baseline. I understood you to say that the calculation that you've made is for the full impact of the new taxes. So you've looked out at what those are going to amount to. But in number three, you're comparing what our full tax burden will be at some point in the future as calculated to the fiscal year 19 current level state tax burden. Is that correct? Or did I misunderstand?
No, yeah. So finding number three, when we're doing the rankings of where Oregon would be, it's looking at the current state fiscal year 19 actuals and then taking our new calculation of fiscal year 19 with the tax changes and then seeing how Oregon would change in the rankings. For the COVID analysis, we then projected out and looked to see, well, what do we think is going to happen and would the share of business taxes really change substantially in the future? And that's finding four.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we go to the next slide, please? I'm not going to go into too much detail here, given the time we have, but I want to just note that this slide provides a summary of our approach, and I'm happy to answer any questions about it. But as I just mentioned in my opening comments, our approach was to look at the current taxes that businesses are paying or paid in fiscal year 19. So those are our baseline business taxes. And then we estimated, well, what is the impact of the new tax changes? And we used primarily third-party estimates for that, and then doing some of our own kind of modeling as well. We then constructed what is then the new with tax changes estimate, so the new tax burden that we could then compare to the baseline, and then we could benchmark with other states, and we could start thinking about how COVID impacts those. So big picture, that's what we did with this study. And I will say one other thing. For some taxes, it's pretty cut and dry that businesses pay that tax, they're legally liable. But for other taxes, it's much more complicated. And, you know, we, for example, on property taxes, which are paid by both businesses and households, luckily there's good data available at the county level where you can pull assessed values. You can see by different property classes, what are the taxes paid? So there are those kinds of, so that kind of work goes into our construction of what taxes are businesses paying. And I see Representative Spence has a question.
There, yes.
Thank you,
Representative Lawrence Spence.
Thank you, Nathanson. My question is a little bit about your process. You talk about, I think Ms. Doug talked about, you know, costs representing Fortune 1000 businesses. And I'm thinking about some of these taxes have thresholds whereby not every business in the state of Oregon would be liable to pay them. And so I wanted to know if you disaggregated your data to think about which businesses are impacted by this this analysis.
Yeah, so this is an aggregate analysis looking at taxes paid, and then we use a different baseline. In this case, we chose GDP as our denominator, but we're looking at, to your point, we're not looking at what is the tax burden on a specific type of business. We do that modeling a lot, and that's a good question. In this case, this is an aggregated look at sort of contributions from all types of business. Okay, can we go to the next slide, please? So here's a summary of the four tax changes that were included in our analysis. We looked at the corporate activity tax, and this table just lays out some information on these taxes, which I know you're all familiar with, but just when, you know, the effective date, three of them being effective this year, the paid family medical leave program being affected in 2022. I'm just going to highlight the business share column, which is the second to the from the right column. So for the corporate activity tax, we looked at revenue estimates for this tax, and we assigned 100% of it as paid by business. The next tax, the individual income tax, as Doug mentioned, pass-through business income is taxed via the individual income tax, and there was a rate reduction that went along with the passage of the corporate activity tax. So we looked at the impact in revenue that declined due to that, those lowering of the rates. I want to note, though, that we're not looking at all of the individual income tax. We're only looking at that portion that is on, that comes from pass-through business income. So we estimate that using, you know, tax data, and we have an estimate about 10% of that tax is coming from businesses. So you can see the 10% business share in that column. Just want to point that out. Third, we looked at the rate increases and the extension of some of the healthcare provider taxes. The ones that we included in our study were the just the insurer taxes on health plan premiums and the assessments on managed care organizations. We didn't include the hospital taxes, for example.
Caroline, I'm going to interrupt you there with a question.
Sure.
Did you it kick around the idea in your shop that the healthcare provider tax actually is returned to the providers. It not exactly, you know, like send a check, get the exact same check back, but the benefit does go straight back to the group that pays it.
Yeah, in this case, and that's a good point. I mean, in this case, we were looking at sort of what is the liability on these, on the premium side, and so not looking specifically at the provider side on the hospital taxes. So we did try to take out some of those that we feel like are, to your point, going straight back. On the premium tax side, we didn't end up including it as a tax on business that's passed down through, that eventually a lot is passed to those that are paying the premiums. And so we made that distinction.
Thank you for your response.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then finally on the state tax side, we included the paid family medical leave program, the 1% payroll tax, and we also apportioned that between the employer portion and the employee portion. And so the business share there is the 40% employer portion. Okay, can we go to the next slide, please? This is a summary of the enacted Portland tax changes when we started the project. So we included the Portland gross receipts tax that went into effect in 2019. We also included the Multnomah County business income tax rate increase. And so we included that. And then the metro income tax that is using to fund housing support services. And that is both a personal income tax and a tax on business profits. Again, we made the distinction on the individual income tax side and only included the portion of the tax that would be on pass-through businesses. So you can see in the business share, again, we have a 10% estimate for that tax. For the business profits tax, the rate increase on the Multnomah business income tax and the gross receipts tax, we've assigned those as all paid by business. And our estimate here for those three taxes, once fully phased in fiscal year 19 level, our estimate was about $177 million in new taxes from those three. Can we go to the next slide? So there were five ballot initiatives and five taxes that were ballot initiatives, and four of them passed. Three of them were property taxes in the Portland area. So the first two, the Portland Parks property tax, which was a new tax, was passed by voters. The Portland Public School debt property tax, so this was an extension of an existing millage, and that passed as well. And then a new tax to fund libraries, and that the Multnomah County Library property tax also passed. So you can see the business share there is 39%, and that is our estimate of business share looking at property class assessed valuations for the metro area, using that data to figure that out. The third from the top, the Multnomah County individual income tax, this was the high earner tax that was on the ballot that's going to fund universal preschool programs in the county. And that has two different brackets, different thresholds for single and joint filers. And again, we only took that portion of the income tax that applies on pass-through business income. There. And for those five taxes, we estimated an increase of business tax contributions of about $52 million once fully phased in on a fiscal year 19 basis. Okay, can we go to the next slide, please? One of the things that we were asked to look at was just the impact of a couple of the local taxes and what it does to Portland's top individual income tax rate, and how does that compare with the rest of the country? So once the taxes are going to effect next year, both the metro income tax for supportive housing, which is that 1%, and then the high earner tax for universal preschool, which for certain income, it goes up to 3%, will raise the state and local combined top tax rate for Portland residents from the current 9.9, which is all the way to the right, to the red bar, which is the 13.9%, and then, you know, puts Portland as sort of the highest rate in the country above San Francisco and Newark, for example. Okay, can we go to the next slide? This is just a summary of what I talked about before, which is here's how the state tax changes compared to the current baseline and how we estimated the 41% increase in $1.8 billion. You can see the corporate activity tax is the majority of the tax change. So we show in the first column the actual business taxes in fiscal year 19. What is then the change in business taxes? So for most of these, there were no tax changes, so they're the same. And then an estimate then in column three of the tax dollar amount change and what is then our overall percentage change in taxes. And so the corporate activity tax increase, the paid family medical leave program, the payroll tax, and then some of the insurer taxes are the sort of the bigger ones, and then a small reduction in the individual income tax due to the lowering of the rates for some of the brackets. Can we go to the next slide? Here's visually just how Oregon then compares when you look at state taxes divided by gross state product. Oregon was at 2%, the effective tax rate for Oregon businesses was 2%, kind of in fiscal year 19 without any tax changes. It was below the US average of 2.4%. And with the tax changes, Oregon's effective tax rate goes up to 2.8%, and it goes higher than some neighbors, such as California and Idaho, but then is still below Washington, Montana, and Nevada. In our analysis. Can we go to the next slide, please? This just shows visually that 23% increase in the city county metro taxes at the Portland metro area level. This includes both the city taxes, the county, and Multnomah County's share of the metro taxes. Again, this is once it's fully phased in, and we've included then the ballot initiatives that passed for that 23% increase. Can we go to the next slide? Here, the change in Oregon's statewide local total effective business tax rate is shown here. So Oregon, before the tax changes, the effective tax rate was 1.8%. And after the tax changes, goes up to 2%, goes ahead of California, but it's still below the US average of 2.2%. Can we go to the next slide? And when you put the state and local analysis together, this is what you have in terms of the change in effective tax rates. So the state and local total effective business tax rate was 3.8% in fiscal year 19. And with the new tax changes, we're estimating it will go up to about 4.8% and higher than the US average, which is 4.5%. Can we go to the next slide? And this just does that total effective tax rate comparison on the state and local side. So all the way to the right is Oregon pre-tax change, that green bar, that 3.8%, which was below most of its neighbors. And then post the tax change, that red bar going up to 4.8% and above the US average.
Okay. Caroline, on the previous slide, that also was about the total effective business tax rate. Mm-hmm. How much of that, if you took out what happened in the Portland region, what would the number be?
Yeah, if you took out what happened in the Portland region, then you would just take over the 1.8. So you're the bulk of the change is the state tax change, that 2 to 2.8%. So we would go down to 4.6.
And then how would that affect the next slide?
If you go to the next slide,
you can see the ranking.
Yeah, so the 4.6 then would still put it in the same spot. So if you took out the local piece of this, it would put it at 4.6. So it'd still be higher than Washington and higher than the U.S. average, but below Nevada and Montana.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, can we go to the next slide? So as I mentioned, we wanted to sort of think about how COVID-19 was going to impact these numbers. And we used some of the forecast data from the state to think about changes in the next few years, particularly around the corporate activity tax and income taxes. And so we took those forecasts and we modeled those reductions in certain taxes and in other taxes, no changes or some slight increases. For example, in the two-year period, we don't have property taxes greatly changing due to how assessments work and the lag. So for example, when we did that analysis, we found that the business share pretty much stayed the same. And some of our estimates in fiscal year 19 actually are decent proxies for what we think is gonna look like in fiscal year 22, particularly around payroll and some of those measures. So when we did this analysis, the main finding was that we felt like our results held. Businesses will pay less in some taxes, about the same in others. The level of economic activity is going to be lower. So at the end of the day, our analysis found about the same and not no real change once we factored in the COVID-19 impacts. Okay. Can we go to the last slide, please? This is just stating what I've told you and what my first slide was, which is just our key findings. Basically on the state tax side, we found a large increase in state business taxes of 41%. We see the increase in the state's total effective business tax rate going from 2% to 2.8%, which then makes Oregon fall in the rankings going from 40th highest state, so one of the 10 lowest, to the 19th highest in our cost results. On the local side, the local tax changes, we estimate that the impact on business is about a 23% increase once those taxes go into effect. And the statewide local total effective business tax change, business tax rate goes from 1.8% to 2%, which is still below the US local average. And then finally, when we put the state and local analysis together, we estimate that the total TABOR increases above the national average of 4.5, and at 4.8% of business activity, that's the new sort of level for state and local taxes compared to 3.8%, which is current. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Scott Bruin for some comments.
Great. Thank you so much, Caroline. Thank you, Madam Chairman and Committee, for the opportunity to present our study this afternoon. I hope it was of value to you. What you saw, simply put, is that in a short period of time, Oregon has moved from a state with a relatively competitive business tax rate and structure to one that is now arguably much less competitive. And I think it's important to put that in practical perspective. Other Western states are able to offer companies better rates than Oregon can. That's not the only consideration, of course. Nevertheless, other Western states can and will sell that fact to any Oregon business, to any business looking to invest or expand in the West, including any Oregon business willing to listen. It's not a sky is falling thing, but it is reasonable to acknowledge that the very real business exodus that happens in some high tax states like California. Well, with the recent changes in Oregon, our effective business tax rate is now above California's. As we head into session, we believe that we need to focus on helping businesses get back on their feet and restore lost jobs. Tax increases in any form, including the euphemistic closing of loopholes, will only make recovery more difficult. Those loopholes, for a lot of struggling businesses, are actually lifelines. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, you're on mute.
Thank you. Thank you to the presenters, and especially to you, Scott. It's nice to see you again. Representative Lawrence Spence has the first question.
Thank you all for your presentation. Robust. I guess my question is about your last statement and how it compares to my first question. So when we talk about recovery efforts and we layer in the impact of COVID-19, and you talk about being able to attract new business and new jobs, you know, when we talk about these Fortune 1000 companies, a lot of their jobs are jobs that people can do remotely. And so what does that mean in terms of attracting businesses whereby we might not see businesses trying to set up shop in these large campus style ways that they have typically, and that change is coming and might be here for in perpetuity as remote working becomes more accessible and more attractive to workers. So how have you layered that into your analysis, and as well as thinking about the fact that the jobs that we've lost tend to be of those where that tax threshold is not completely, because we didn't disaggregate the data, we're not seeing how it really impacts those businesses where they need people on the ground, where they need people to physically be in a space, versus those Fortune 1000 companies that can have workers work remotely. So just how did your analysis take that into consideration?
So I think the first, I'm not muted. I think the first part of the question, Representative, is how does the changing work environment, given remote consideration, given how, you know, if I work for, I don't know, Hewlett Packard in the Bay Area, but I was here in, you know, Westland, Oregon, how would that be taxed? Let me see if I can turn that over to either Caroline or Doug to see if they have any perspective on that. I think it's a really good question.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. And let me start kind of big picture, all states, and I'll let Caroline talk about how it affects Oregon. You're absolutely right. We are entering a new normal. And my view is that Oregon has a little bit of an advantage there. If I wanted to work from home, Oregon is one of those places where if I want to work remotely, you've got a lot to offer. But right now during the pandemic, some companies have said, we're going to go to a virtual workplace all the time. Some companies have said, we're going to come back in as soon as we can. So it's really uncertain how pervasive the work from home or the work from here model will be. Certainly some of it will be, but a lot of folks rely on the networking and the collaboration that you can only get from in working in campus. And you know, if those companies do go to a virtual workplace, you want those workers to be in Oregon because you then get the benefit of their individual income tax. Right now, a lot of states are allowing companies during the pandemic to either withhold at the location of where they originally worked or withhold at the place they are working now based on the system that the company has in place, you know, acknowledging that in our hope that the pandemic is temporary and will pass through. Now, Caroline, you want to comment on how that affected your calculations?
Yeah, no, this is a very thoughtful question. And I completely agree that the tax system affects different types of businesses differently. And then particularly too, when you layer in what is the operating profile, what does their capital investment structure look like, what do their customers look like, what are the incentives that there was, I mean, absolutely right. That's a very complicated question. And you see effective tax rates that really differ by industry and type of business and size of business. And our analysis doesn't go into those effects. It's looking at it at an aggregate level. When you're talking about, though, that workers are working remotely, then it gets in the question of what is the household tax burden look like and how does Oregon compare? What are some of the changes? And, you know, we touched on this a little bit because we started layering, obviously, because of the pass-through business income component, we started looking at the individual income tax changes, particularly in the Portland area, which, you know, for certain earners is now a 4% increase or a 4 percentage point increase, which is pretty large. So there is that question of, is it attractive? Are you attractive to sort of high earner workers that want to still stay in that area? those are some of the questions. You know, we only touched on it a little bit in the study.
This is Nikki, if I might jump in on that one.
Sure. Go ahead, just be sure to state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nikki Dobe, a partner with Evershed Sutherland. I'm working with OBI on this study. And I would just follow up on Caroline's comment. I think Portland in particular has put itself in a bit of a spot, as it's a very challenging place to attract workers that may be remote at this point. I do a lot of work in other Western states, and I can very much say states like Idaho and Montana, with much lower personal income tax rates, are doing everything in their power to attract those employees that now have the freedom to work from wherever. So I think that is definitely a question that employees are considering as they leave very high tax areas, because they do have that flexibility. So just something to keep in mind, and that's generally all based on personal income tax rates.
Thank you. And I assume that's not talking so much about the manufacturing sector, where you need people at the location, which is a topic that Representative Lawrence Spence mentioned. Representative Lawrence Spence, did you have a follow-up you were going to ask?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I wanted to say thank you all for your very comprehensive and team effort on that answer. I appreciate that. I also had another question based on what you laid out in the beginning. Caroline, you said that you were going to talk a bit more about the benefits businesses are deriving from the taxes they pay, and I didn't really hear that come full circle, so I wanted to know if you could touch on that a little further.
Yep, great question. So as Doug mentioned this in our annual 50 state tax burden study, we do that calculation for all 50 states. So it's not in the OBI report that we just did, but we do have all those calculations in the cost study, which is online. And so in that study, or in that calculation, we look at what are the benefits that business get from government operations. And one of the big questions is, how much does education and building up human capital really benefit businesses versus is that something the individual retains and benefits from? And so we do a calculation that looks at, if you assign, and because education is such a large expenditure, we assign different portions of that as benefiting business to then come to do that calculation of the benefit businesses receive at the state, from the state and local government, compared to the taxes that they contribute, and we calculate that. In Oregon, the most recent number, when you look at, and if you say 50% of educational expenditures benefit business, that ratio is 1-to-1. So the taxes that businesses contribute, they get back the same amount in benefit. Now, going forward, our study suggests that calculation in this report next year is going to go down, because the taxes are going up. And so then the question is the benefit side going to go up by as much? Probably not. So I think we're going to see next year, whereas Oregon was sort of, with that assumption, was seeing a 1-to-1 benefit to cost calculation for business. That's going to change next year. And I don't know, Doug, if you have anything you want to chime in with.
You hit that very well. Thanks, Caroline. I just want to point out that any tax that's levied on a business has to be reflected in one of three areas, right? Either through higher prices, or either through lower wages on the workers, or through a lower return on investment. And most people who levy taxes on businesses really want to get to the owners, right? They're the ones that are perceived to be making the money. The difficulty there is that if you return that, if you lower that return on investment, that's a very mobile investment. I mean, they can fairly shift it. So in most cases, and this takes an analysis of the markets within which companies are operating, a business tax is either reflected through higher prices on consumers or lower wages on the workers in the majority of cases. And now, as Caroline pointed out, there is, most economists will tell you that there is a logic to having businesses pay for the benefits they receive. And that is the calculation that is done in the business tax burden study that I could refer you to, that shows that at the top end of the assumption that businesses benefit from 50%, it's one to one before the tax increases. But at the bottom end, and these are assumptions that were laid out by the Chicago Fed, so not made by us or EY, but through an independent set of economists. At the bottom end, there's a sense that businesses should not be attributed to, you know, or given the benefit of any education, because it is a societal benefit, and it is, as Caroline said, human capital and clearly a personal benefit. So I hope that helps. This is not an easy question to address.
Absolutely. I it does help. I think, you know, zeroing in on the definition of benefit is one that we can debate. So I think it's helpful, and I will definitely refer to that study. So thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I think Rep. Lauren Spence is really onto something, because the issue here is not just the definition of benefit, is also the assessment of the timing of that benefit. And I just wonder, as we invested in the Student Success Act, which is a substantial portion of the increase that you are seeing in Oregon, in the Oregon tax burden, we acknowledged that if that works, we will start to see a benefit in the form of more prepared employees, better students, better high school outcomes, but not for a while, because we are at the front end of a very long-term investment that we believe will have a significant advantages for business, but it's going to take a while to get there. Similarly, with the early childhood investment in the city of Portland, I mean, we all know that brains develop 90% of their capacity by the time of kindergarten. So investments in early childhood are certainly going to pay off as those children grow and become older students and then part of our workforce. But again, the payoff isn't anything that we can measure immediately. It is a long-term payoff in terms of the business communities. And I think finally, in terms of paid family leave, again, that's an advantage that's going to materialize for businesses over a period of time. So what we are really looking for when we make these long-term investments is a corporate commitment to the long-term welfare of our communities. And I wonder if you could just speak to that and how, if anyway, these kinds of calculations can incorporate or even reflect in some way sort of what our long-term objectives are that I think include all of us.
Thank you, Representative. Madam Chair, let me take the first non-scientific crack at that, and I think that's a great question, and then I'll turn it over to Nikki and Caroline and Doug for the more scientific answer. So I guess just to kind of go out of the gates on this, what we're not arguing, or nor is the study making the case, is that these investments are not valuable. This is not a judgment or an assessment of the value of the investments. The public investments that these tax dollars make, from everything from, you know, childhood educations, you know, all the good things that these do. There's no question that with increased revenues, there's increased opportunities to invest that in good works. What this study is really trying to make the point of is that at some point, the source of those of that revenue, the source of that income, you start seeing diminished returns. And so Oregon has gone from a state with a relatively competitive business tax rate structure. Now, we've had other issues because we don't have sales tax. We get all that. But overall, in a 50-state comparison, up until a few years ago, we were arguably in the very competitive side when it came to business taxes. In the very rapid short-term changes that have happened, we've seen that swing quite dramatically. And so what we're saying is, at some point, the burden becomes so much that our ability to attract the investments that we need to remain competitive in whatever field, that whatever industry sector you can think of, or to hire, to retain those employees, or to create the new jobs, it becomes diminished. So that's, I just want to, at least in my own head, make clear that's a different analysis than the value of what the tax resources are going to pay for.
thank you for that response. We are already almost 20 minutes past our scheduled time. If the committee would like to ask one or two more questions, anyone who hasn't asked a question yet, let's do that now, but try to wrap up in just maybe 5 minutes if we can.
Rep Nathanson, I think Caroline was going to also respond to the last question. Do we have time to hear from her?
I think so. I don't see any hands up from other committee members yet. Yeah, Caroline.
Okay, excellent. I really like that question. And I think what you're getting at too is this long run value calculation. And I do spend a lot of time thinking about what are the economic benefits of education. And I've done quite a bit of modeling around that. So I completely agree with you that that's a worthwhile effort and thinking about the investments and what is the most, what are some of the uses of the tax dollars and where are they going and how do those programs and what is the long run benefit? So I absolutely do those calculations. They were outside of the parameters of what we were narrowly looking at with this study. But I think you're asking excellent questions. And I, you know, in all of my modeling work, you know, you can see those quality investments and how they pay off for the individual. And then you can also read the literature about the productivity of workers and how that does translate into benefits for business as well. I agree with you.
After today's meeting, I'd appreciate it if Doug or Caroline, Scott, if someone would send to us, you can just send it to Legislative Revenue Office. Send a link to that study where the benefits are described and mention what pages or section to zero in on.
We'll do that, Chair.
We'd be happy to.
Thank you. And I'd like to chime in on along the lines that Representatives Lawrence, Spence, and Marsh have been talking. Because the corporate activity tax accounted for the large portion of that increase, and because it is targeted exclusively to education, that tax increase looks pretty different, probably, the benefits of it look pretty different than a general tax increase, which is spread thinly across a general purpose government, just is supporting a range of different kinds of agencies and programs and services. And also thinking about Representative Marsh's comment about it will take some years to see the full benefit of this investment. The full benefit will also yield a positive change in the social fabric of our state and in health. What we spend on health care and the costs to business, for whether it's paying for health care insurance or lost productivity, apart from the tragic circumstances for individuals and workers, if we're looking at costs to business or benefits to business, I think that there's also a benefit with this investment in education in better health outcomes also. So I'm hoping that at some future time, Caroline might be able to point us to something that it is a thought paper on that topic. Any other committee members with questions that we haven't gotten to yet? I don't see any hands. Okay, thank you all for your presentation and for sticking with us for a great discussion, responding to the committee members' questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very much appreciated.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next agenda item, Mr. Alanak, take us to the next one.
So the next item is Kyle's going to make a presentation on tax credits. So just to refresh the committee, back in 2009, the legislature put all of the tax credits into one of three bins with an automatic sunset of a six-year cycle. So beginning with the 2011 session, the legislature had a process to review these tax credits. And then beginning with 2015, the Legislative Revenue Office was tasked with producing a report on the tax credits that were scheduled to sunset that biennium. And we have gone through a full cycle, if you will, 15, 17, and 19. And so this coming session, we kind of go back to that, the 2015 cycle, that first cycle where Legislative Revenue had to produce a report on those sunsetted tax credits. Kyle has taken over the task of doing that report. And so he's giving you a preview of the tax credits that will be sunsetting next biennium, and those that are a large chunk of the LCs that Chair Nathanson was referring to this morning, where they're placeholder bills to extend the tax credits by 6 years. So Kyle will be presenting that.
Okay, well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, as Chris just set that up, what I plan to cover today is just kind of a preview of what will be coming in the 2021 session. And it is related to that tax credit review process that was devised and really set up by the legislature as far back as a decade ago. I do have a couple slides or a few slides in OLIS that I'll be working from in the meeting materials. I'll go ahead and get that brought up here momentarily. Okay, so really just what I wanted to touch on today, again, this is sort of a preview of what will be coming in the 2021 session. And it's a topic certainly that many of the members are familiar with, as I know many have been through one, if not multiple, of these tax credit review processes in the past. But again, the process itself, as Chris mentioned, was set up over a decade ago, and it really sets places, the idea in the beginning was to set up a process where all the tax credits would be reviewed. And to accomplish that, rather than trying to review all the tax credits that were on the books all in one session, instead, rather the credits were categorized into categorize the credits into a similar policy function, and then review each of a group of the credits each of the long legislative sessions. So really how that's been set up is more or less there's almost three categories or three groupings of tax credits that have been scheduled to review. And as Chris mentioned, this group that's coming up in 2021 is up for more or less its second iteration of review. So these were last reviewed back in 2015. So again, what I wanted to cover today is just a quick review of some of these topics. Again, as many of the members are well aware of these, as they were part of the last review process just about 2 years ago. But again, was to set it up with a quick general background on tax expenditures, talk briefly about the importance of sunsets, although there's you'll have more discussion on that in the next agenda item, touch on the tax credit review process that's been set up and used in the past, and then I'll finish with the listing of tax credits that are up for review in the 2021 session, and hit on some of the what I've labeled as the themes of the tax credits that are up here in 2021 for sunset review. So just really briefly on the background on tax expenditures, credits are just one subset of tax expenditures. And again, a tax expenditure, we do have a definition in ORS 291-201. Mm-hmm. The general idea here is just anything that deviates from the tax base is generally going to be considered a tax expenditure. There are, as I said, credits are just one subset of tax expenditures that exist. We do have other things you can think of, deductions, property tax exemptions, all fit under the definition of tax expenditure. And a note on other sources as well, in addition to the tax credit report that LRO prepares, that is sort of a document trying to provide some overview and background of the credits up for sunset review in 2021, you also have the governor's tax expenditure report, which covers all the tax expenditures and is released as a secondary document to the governor's recommended budget. So that was released recently as well. In terms of the income tax expenditures, again, the credits are just one subset of the overall tax expenditures. And it has been a group that the legislature has generally focused on in the past due to the nature of what a tax credit is, and oftentimes a tax credit having a specific policy purpose of something it's trying to achieve. Related to the sunsets, I won't spend much time on this because I know this will be touched on the next agenda item, but just the importance of the sunsets is it really sets the stage for the tax credit review process. So nearly all tax credits on the books have a sunset in place right now. And the importance of that sunset is it more or less removes the credit from law in some ways. That's a slight oversimplification, but the idea is the legislature, it requires an act of the legislature to extend a particular tax credit. So absent a change by the legislature, a bill being passed extending that sunset, these tax credits are scheduled to go away, more or less. So it really facilitates, part of the reason of placing that sunset is to require that review process rather than being the status quo of the credits exist and it takes a bill to end the tax credits. Right now, the status quo is, well, all these tax credits are under current law scheduled to sunset at a certain time. But again, that's kind of the importance of this, the sunsets, and I know there'll be more discussion later in the committee hearing here. In terms of the requirements, one thing that accompanies the tax credit review process is a report that LRO puts together. We are in the process of finishing that report, and it will be available leading up or at the beginning of the long session here in 2021. Included in this is a report that is required by statute. There are 11 things, 11 deliverables or things that the report is to contain. One of the things I will touch on, I won't go through all 11 of them, of course, is the importance of the stated policy purpose. And that really is the starting point for a lot of the tax credit review and also for the report that LRO provides as well, is to first identify, well, what is the policy purpose of the credit? And from there, that really flows to, well, how do you review the credit? How do you determine whether a credit achieves its desired purpose? Well, the step one is just to identify its purpose. So we spend some time there, and that is included in the report. And that's also, the legislature has recognized the importance, I suppose, of the purpose statement. And there is required in statute that for newly proposed tax credits or an expansion of a tax credit would include a statement of purpose by the chief sponsor or a proponent of the measure. And one of the things LRO does to try to make these purposes more transparent or easier to find, I suppose, is to include a policy purpose statement in the revenue impact statement for a bill when it's being passed out of committee. So you will find a purpose statement there as well as in our report related to the tax credits for review. Also included in the report, just one other thing, is sort of a look back of the revenue impact of tax credits in the past. And the idea here is to perhaps look at, well, what was the estimate at the time that a new credit was enacted? What was the revenue impact estimate at that time? And then a few years later, once we have return data, tax return data, what is the actual cost? And how does that compare with the estimate being made? With the idea to try to facilitate, maybe that has impact on how the legislature is reviewing these credits at a later date. But again, that is included as in the appendix of the report as well. Mm-hmm. Now, the past tax credit review process, Chris mentioned this a little bit, the process has usually been set up by individual LCs or individual bills related to each of the tax credits that simply extend the sunset of the individual credit. And the idea here is it's just a standard sunset extension, and that facilitates the review process in the legislature. And we've kind of thought of this as maybe there's three stages. We have the interim process, that's the preparing of the report, really. And the next step would be once you get into the legislative session, there's almost two steps for how these bills work their way through. And generally, it's been the bills have been sent to the policy, a policy committee first that has some hook to the credit. Maybe it's a credit related to a housing policy, in which case it might go to a housing policy committee first. And then if it passes out of that committee, it'll make its way to, generally it's been the Joint Tax Credit Committee, but it can also make its way to either the House or the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee as well. But again, we do generally have the individual committee LCs prepared for just that standard six-year review. And really that's a placeholder to allow for that process to work and to function. In terms of what's in the report that'll be forthcoming, again, I mentioned what's required in statute, keying off there the description of the policy purpose, and then trying to give some background analysis that is helpful, hopefully, to the legislature in the review process. So it's more, a little bit more of a deep dive into the individual credits that are up for review. One thing I would note is when this report is released, Eller also makes an effort. We generally will go to the policy committees as well when those bills, those individual sunset extension bills, are being discussed at the policy committees as too, to try to present the report findings and help inform any committee discussion at the policy level as well. So in terms of the 2021 tax credit report and the credits that are up for review, again, this is, in many ways, it's a second iteration for many of these credits. So most of the credits that are coming in 2021 for review were previously reviewed in 2015. So in 2015, there were 19 credits in total that were reviewed, 9 of which were allowed to sunset, 2 were combined into a single credit, 1 was spun off, and then 6 of them were modified. So only 2 of the credits were extended, had their sunset extended without any changes or modifications made to the credit. And that's just kind of important in that there, and there certainly could be more modifications since 2015 as well, but it's important to, I guess, keep in mind that many of these credits have already been looked at by the legislature and may have already had some policy tweaks or changes made previously as well. In 2021, right now we're looking at 11 tax credits to be reviewed, 10 of which were previously reviewed or created, and then we have our in 2015, and one new was created in 2017. In terms of the themes of the 2021 credit review, I'll touch on these points here in just a moment, but I'll go ahead and just move forward to the list of the tax credits that are scheduled to sunset and then the cost of extending these tax credits. So this is a table you all are probably familiar with as you've seen before, but the way this is set up just for a review is you have the name and then the number of the tax credit that is associated with the tax expenditure report. And then we have the sunset date and then estimates of the cost to extend that tax credit. And again, the estimates here represent just a simple sunset extension. It doesn't include any modifications to the underlying policy of the credit or anything of that nature. So it's just a simple sunset extension. But the way to read this is you have each of the listings of each of the individual tax credits, but you do have these costs to extend. So again, the way that the law is set up right now is under current law, these tax credits are scheduled to sunset. Many or most of these following the 2021 tax year. And the importance of that is because these tax credits are on the books through 2021, they really sunset during midway through the 21-23 biennium. And that's why you see the total cost to extend for the 21-23 biennium for all these tax credits would be about $50 million, $50.1 million is their estimate right now. In 23-25, that goes to 102.6. So that's a little more than double, and that's reflective in part of just the cost to extend would cover really 2 tax years in 23-25, whereas in 21-23, you're really only extending it 1 year, because 1 year is already on the books under current law.
Kyle, Representative Reschke has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Kyle. I think you just answered my question. I was wondering how many months were in that 21 through 23 biennium as far as the tax credit, and you seem to say the 21 years is accounted for already, and then it seems like is it 18 months or 12 months? What percentage are we in the, does it get cut off if it ends?
Yes, Representative Reschke, that's an excellent question. In many cases, when reviewing the credits, we generally view it as just a split midway through. Whenever we look at things, sometimes there can be a timing on how those revenue flows come in, but for credits, we generally just look at that on a per tax year basis.
As a general rule of thumb, half or 50% of the, okay, that, yes. And that seems to line up. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so just continuing on and just hitting some of the themes here of 2021 is similar to the last review process that occurred in 19, is you can see in this case about 60% of the overall $50 million cost to extend is going to be driven by one credit. So in the last review process, those that earned income tax credit, in this case, it's the working family household and dependent care credit at about $32 million of the total $50 million is that cost to extend in just one credit. So you do see some of that cost being really being focused on one credit driving the overall cost. Additionally, there was credits, there's three credits that are incentivizing or leveraging private contributions. Just going back one slide briefly here. The Public University Venture Development Fund contributions to the Office of Child Care and the Individual Development Account contributions are three credits that in some ways can be a little bit different in that they're devised to incentivize individuals to make contributions to a fund that then is used to uses funding for expenditure purposes in some cases. And the reason these ones have been grouped together and kind of highlighted for their importance was a change is probably not the right word, but in 2018, IRS rules and regulations came out making it explicit the relation to states that make tax credits available for these contributions and then how taxpayers are to treat those in terms of deducting those contributions made on their federal return as say a charitable contribution. So that really has changed the environment a bit for these three credits. And again, that'll be covered in more detail in the report and discussed at a later date. In terms of just the last categories there that I touched on was thinking income maintenance, grouping some of the credits into income maintenance. We have a group related to healthcare, and then finally a grouping of business. And again, it's important to understand a lot of these credits can touch on different areas. So this is just a first chance or a first shot at trying to group these into have some sort of theme or a category in which to view these credits. But again, different credits can have different incentives or different reasons that they exist and what they're trying to achieve. But again, then just finishing up here on the second page of this estimates page are the other tax credits that are scheduled for review right now based upon their sunset date. We have three in 2023 and then a group scheduled for review in 2025. And this group may look familiar as this was the listing of credits that were reviewed this past 2019 session. And again, just one thing I would note here is on the estimates, because of the timing of when these credits are scheduled to sunset, you'll notice that the cost to extend hit in different biennials. So if a credit isn't scheduled to sunset until 25-27, there's really no cost to extend in 21-23 or 23-25 because that's already accounted for. They're on the books, they're under current law right now, so there is no extending them as of right now. They're already accounted for in the revenue forecast, if you will. But again, that's just trying to touch on a high-level review of what will be coming in 2021. And happy to take any questions if people have any.
Thank you. Questions? I'm not seeing any questions yet. I'll make a comment now that might. Representative Kenny Geyer, would you mind waiting just a moment?
No problem.
I was going to mention something that I've mentioned previously, which is I hope to be able to use a somewhat more robust review process in the Revenue Committee, but also to encourage other policy committees that are reviewing tax expenditures to review not only some sort of nuts and bolts, like, is this a good idea? Yeah, it's a nice idea. That's great. We love helping work toward reducing hunger, for example, or toward reducing poverty, or help this group of people or that group of people. What I hope we look at, though, is the tax credit may have been effective, but was it just as effective as it would have been if there had been more investment in direct program spending? Whether it's outright grants to individuals and businesses or through a program where we fund food banks, for example, if the issue is to address hunger. So I'm hoping to encourage that kind of a conversation on not only is the tax credit likely working, but is it as cost effective, or even from a service and program and achieving objectives point of view, is it as effective as another way of spending our money? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's hard to believe it's 6 years since we worked on some of these. The child care tax credit was something that our Human Services and Housing Committee took on and worked very closely with Chris Allenack and had a whole task force and I had a Republican counterpart, and we combined what had been the federal job and development credit with the working family tax credit and made it leaner and did exactly, Madam Chair, what you suggested, was, which was look at what the end goals were and what are the other ways that we're trying to do that and how does this tax credit fit in. So I just wanted to say that I dug into that. I have that on my computer. I'm curious to see how it's done. I'm looking forward to reading the report to see how it's done compared to what we had hoped. And I will not be there in the 2021 legislature, but I remember all of this very well. It's hard to believe it's 6 years, and I'm happy to be of service. As you look at the ones that I worked on, child with a children with disability was another one we worked on very hard. So thank you for your direction, Chair Nathanson. I think it's incredibly important that policy chairs take this very seriously before they send it to your committee.
Thank you for that comment. Other committee members, questions or comments? Oh, let's see. I'm not seeing any others. Okay. I think that's the end of this item. Mr. Allenack, did you have anything you wanted to add as we close out this agenda item?
No, this does segue well into the next item. It's all on the topic of tax expenditures.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay, so the next item is, and I have an in, is related to another report that LRO was working on. It's basically homework from the 2019 session. House Bill 2128 required a report by LRO, and this is one where Kate, Jamie, and I have been working on. Amid other things, I'm going to share this one pager that is in OLIS around 2128 update. And this is just kind of a preview of the report that is due by February 1st. So just to refresh the committee's memory, House Bill 2128 is a report to focus on, to study the kind of intersection, if you will, of the statutory definition of a tax expenditure and the operation of automatic sunsets. So I have that at the top of this page, and then I have those two key pieces of statute listed next. So we have the tax expenditure definition. I think everybody, we won't go into that in detail, but that's the report that Kyle just went through was on tax credits, and tax expenditures can mean a lot of other things, including property tax exemptions, deductions, and so forth. And then the key piece of statute are the automatic sunsets that got put in place back in 2009 when the tax credit review process was put in place. Statute 315.037 was created, and there was an automatic or default sunset of 6 years for any tax credit. Well, in 2013, the legislature extended that definition to any tax expenditure. And that's what I have highlighted there under subsection 3 of the automatic or implicit sunset. And so what we have now in statute, we have this definition of tax expenditures really feeding the tax expenditure report, which has been created since the mid-1990s by the Department of Revenue as a companion to the governor's budget. We have this other report on tax credits by the Legislative Revenue Office for the past 5 or 6 years. And this implicit sunset issue has started to come up last time and has really raised a number of questions. And those questions, we kind of got stuck in the 2019 session, and that resulted in the statute for the 2128 report. The primary issue that we're dealing with, that stakeholders are dealing with, is really the application or the implementation of this implicit sunset date and how that relates to tax expenditures. And that's the gist of this report. So some of the points of discussion that we're trying to flesh out in the report are listed here at the bottom of the page. So I was just going to touch on those briefly. The first one is a tax expenditure definition or determination versus a default sunset policy. And it really gets at what does the legislature want to sunset. We have these tax expenditures. We have this tax expenditure report that's been around for 25 years. It's primarily been a policy tool for stakeholders to review and look for policies that maybe should be ended or modified somehow. And there's always been an open interpretation of what a tax expenditure is. And in many ways, it was a policy debate or an academic debate about what is or is not. And people could disagree about what is a tax expenditure. The trick that we've gotten ourselves into is with this default sunset policy that creates an actual consequence for a tax expenditure that gets created. And if the legislature doesn't speak to whether or not there's a sunset on there, that's when ORS 315.037, the implicit sunset, will kick in. And, well, what does that mean and how do we deal with that? How do the executive branch agencies deal with that? And it really gets at this issue of what does the legislature want to sunset? And the determination so far, the way the statute was presented, one could read it as though the notion of a tax expenditure were clear to everybody, that it's obvious what is or is not a tax expenditure. And for many cases, that is, I would say that is a fair assessment. There are a number of items, perhaps on the fringes, if that's the way to phrase it, where there's a debate if something is or is not a tax expenditure. So because 315.037 doesn't explicitly identify who makes that determination, the nature of our statutes is that that decision is left to the executive branch and the administrative agency. Usually in this case, it's the Department of Revenue, although it certainly could be other agencies. There was an issue in 2019 that was a Department of Transportation issue. And then it really falls on that executive branch agency to figure out and determine what is or is not a tax expenditure purely for the purpose of what does or does not sunset. Now, the only other place I could find in statute that dealt with this notion of a tax expenditure is in ORS 173.025, which are LRO statutes, if you will, involving the revenue impact statements. And if there is a tax expenditure that is created or extended, then we are required to include certain information on our revenue impact statements, kind of like the policy purpose. And so how all of these pieces fit together is really the crux of potential disagreement for stakeholders. Other issues that the report that we're getting into is the definition of established taxes. And you can see that up there in the definition for a tax expenditure. And there's an open question as to exactly what that means. And again, the importance of this is prior to the implicit sunsets, these were kind of academic policy debates. But now there are real consequences to the legislature saying the sunset policy applies to all tax expenditures created after January 1, 2014. So there are open ways to interpret this an established tax. Is that the session that it was created, for example, or is it just the notion of an existing, in the economics literature, of an income tax or a property tax? And embedded in that is the nature of a tax base. And the legislature went through this in 2019 with the corporate activity tax about what is or isn't part of the tax base. And in some ways, it's two sides of the same coin, where if you have some amount of income or property or activity that is not subject to the tax base, well, then is it just not part of the desired tax base, or is it a tax expenditure? And if it is a tax expenditure, then if the legislature doesn't speak to the sunset date, it may be subject to this implicit sunset. And the last bullet point I just wanted to throw out there was or is the Oregon Tax Expenditure Report. It's been around for 25 years or so. And for the most part, it's been, I think, used as I described, a policy resource. It's a great compendium. It's a pretty thick book, and it has a lot of information about Oregon's tax system. The place where we're kind of getting into, and this really came up in 2019, is some stakeholders might have a particular policy that they're interested in, and may not feel that it's a tax expenditure, but they see it in the tax expenditure report and they interpret that as some sort of legal interpretation or legal statement that this provision is in fact a tax expenditure. And again, the only importance of that is its connection to the sunset policy. And the Department of Revenue in the tax expenditure report, because of these questions about provisions that may or may not be tax expenditures, I think they've generally taken a view of erring on the side of transparency, if you will, and including some provisions that may not be tax expenditures, but providing them and including them in the book for the sake of that policy resource perspective and use of the book. So that was just a high level overview of what you'll be getting in this report over the next month or so. I mean, we'll wrap it up and present it to you, and we'll have a presentation to go through it all. One of the for those who have been involved in tax expenditure discussions, they can be incredibly interesting or incredibly painful. I mean, they get into a lot of minutia around tax policy. And one area that we've been circling around so far is, well, why do we really worry about the definition of a tax expenditure? Does that really matter? And in many ways, it doesn't, except to the extent that it's tied to this automatic sunset policy. The legislature has said, we want certain things to sunset automatically so they don't fall through the cracks. And what the legislature has stated in statute is those things are tax expenditures. So there are a number of potential ways where the committee can move forward on this, at least some of the ideas that we've discussed internally at LRO and with DOR. And I'm sure committee members will have existing ideas or new ideas will come up. But it's really that the connection there and getting back at whether or not you still want that sunset policy to be created. Another note to keep in mind is that when these were created, 2009, 2013, our legal understanding of what requires a 3/5 vote was very different. 10 years ago, at that time, the elimination of a tax expenditure, putting a sunset date on a tax expenditure, required a 3/5 vote. That was our understanding of the legal landscape. Now that has fundamentally changed, and we have a lot more clarity due to some tax court cases. And now, ending a tax expenditure, repealing a tax expenditure, placing a sunset date on a tax expenditure doesn't require a 3/5 vote. It's not viewed as a bill for raising revenue, because all of that affects the tax base. And where we are now on this legal landscape is a change in a tax rate is what triggers the 3/5 vote. Every tax at its core component consists of a tax base. What is it you're going to tax? Property, income, sales, and then the rate at which you tax it. Changing the tax rate or increasing the tax rate is what triggers the 3/5 vote. Changing that tax base does not. So that's something else to keep in mind just as we roll into the 21 session and as we try to wrap up this report. So that's all I had. I don't know if there are any questions.
Representative Lawrence Spence.
I'm very grateful for this. I won't be here in a month to receive the full report. So I guess I have several questions. I'll start with the first one being, what is I'm trying to weigh the cost to continuously have to go back and rethink these expenditures as they sunset. Is there an administrative cost, or, you know, I'm trying to weigh what is it we're trying to balance here? Is it a cost of doing it? Is there not a benefit to having to address certain of these expenditures on a 6-year timeline so that we can reassess them or, like you said, change them should they need to be adjusted, et cetera? I'm trying to just balance why, you know, but outside of the fact that there's a large definition of what a tax expenditure is, if there's a cost to it or if there's something administratively that's difficult about having it sunset.
Maybe I'll take that backwards and kind of by implication. The reason for doing that is comparing what would be what typically gets referred to as indirect spending through the tax code and comparing that to the direct spending process, the appropriations process, which gets a review every 2 years. And over the years, the notion of a tax expenditure itself can be somewhat controversial. Some of the names that these get referred to are loopholes, subsidies. There's a lot of characterization of what they are. So the intent of pulling them into some sort of review process is to, maybe an equal footing isn't the best way to phrase it, but using the direct appropriations process. Okay, through the Ways and Means process, we review agency budgets and all of the spending on a biennial basis. Prior to any sort of formal review process for tax expenditures, some of these items would be on the books and they would just, nobody would ever look at them again. So part of the value of an automatic sunset is that they do come up and it helps the legislature manage when they get reviewed. The legislature can review any of these at any time. That's certainly fine. This automatic process helps kind of organize that as well. And one point that Kyle touched on is that the prior debate, if a tax expenditure does not have a sunset date, stakeholders can come in and argue why that program needs to be repealed or why it needs to be ended. With an automatic sunset, that policy discussion is changed, and the advocates for that policy need to come in and say, well, this is why it should be continued. The cost to that so far is largely within the legislative branch. I guess it's the time for LRO to work on it. It's the committee time during a session to review it. Any executive branch agencies that work on it, and even to that extent, the full tax expenditure report is paid for through DOR's budget. So those would be the costs that get into that information on reviewing these.
So, Mr. Alanak, would it be a fair conclusion that it might cost a few thousand dollars worth of staff time for several millions of dollars of a revenue loss or foregone revenue?
Yeah, I think that's a fair calculation, you know, using the numbers kind of as an example. And really revisiting those policies. If a tax expenditure that is designed to incentivize some kind of behavior and it's figured out that that's not needed, then that's wasted money and maybe that's better reallocated. It could go the other direction that maybe that incentive should be increased.
Yeah. Very often it's not only because of a program analysis, let's say, of the value of a tax expenditure or specifically a tax credit. It's usually a tax credit. It's not only that. It's generally because we're dealing with budget shortfalls and the Ways and Means process has determined that they want to spend only a certain amount of money on this indirect spending, as you pointed out. And so then they give us what they call the tax credit budget. And that results in the committee having to make choices about this one is more important than that one.
Yes.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you. In your experience, Chris, in being a part of this process for as long as you have, is 6 years enough time to analyze the efficacy of an expenditure or tax credit?
It depends. One of the things that has really highlighted this, and again, Kyle touched on this, is the purpose, the public, the policy purpose of a tax credit, at least in that report. It would apply to all tax expenditures. But to evaluate them, we really need a clear understanding of what the legislative intent is and what is trying to be achieved. And just flipping through the tax expenditure report, you can see that that policy purpose is usually missing. And so we're at a stage now, and again, we've been doing this, some form of this process for about 10 years, recognizing, okay, we want to be clear about policy purposes for these incentives, if you will, or these tax expenditures. And then the other thing that has really become clear is the value of data related to them. And so that's another, kind of tying it to your earlier question about the cost, is we grant this incentive, and sometimes the argument is that it's cheaper to grant a tax credit or other tax expenditure than have a direct spending administrative program, because the administrative costs are less. But there are pros and cons to going each direction. So I would think 6 years, in my experience, it's good to check in. It doesn't always have to be a full bore review of the tax credit, tax expenditure. Sometimes it'll be just checking in, and sometimes a more concise analysis can see if we're going in the right direction or not, as well as identifying, okay, we need more information on this or more information on that. So I wouldn't treat every 6 years as the same level of in-depth analysis is in my experience would be the way to go.
Thank you.
Other questions or discussion?
If no one else has one, I have one.
Just one more, because we're a few minutes, a little bit over, and we should adjourn by a quarter till.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. And Chris, this will be on you to keep this short. What is an example of a tax expenditure that is not a tax credit that would come under, that would fall under this sunset?
The implicit sunset?
Yeah.
There have been... Well, I think that's an open question, because it comes down to whether or not one believes a policy is, in fact, a tax expenditure. For example, the corporate activity tax that we created, there are a number of things that were not part of that tax base. You go with groceries, for example. Is that a tax expenditure or not? And some of these provisions can be pretty significant about whether or not they are tax expenditures. And that's probably, that's a good question. I don't actually have a really good example of one of those.
What about we have LC 2454 exemption for port property?
Yeah, I can't remember if that had an explicit or an implicit sunset date. I'd have to look that up. That one might be an implicit one. I can't recall off the top of my head. And the situation here would be for the 21 for the Revenue Committee to figure out how to address that. Because if the committee doesn't feel it's a tax expenditure, we want to proceed carefully with modifying statute to address that. For example, one way that we've talked about addressing this is this provision is not a tax stating it's not a tax expenditure, or saying notwithstanding 315.037, but the legal interpretation there is anytime we say something one place in statute that has repercussions for other parts of statute. So we just need to proceed carefully.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've always been perplexed about why the mortgage interest deduction doesn't have a sunset of 6 years and a review. And I'm guessing that's because it's connected to the federal tax. Is that the right? Is that why?
The implicit sunsets begin for tax expenditures created after January 1, 2014. So that particular one has been in existence for a long time. That would be my view as to why it doesn't have it, because when the legislature did this for credits in 2009 and tax expenditures in 2013, it was just that point moving forward for any new ones created after that time period.
This is our last scheduled meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, or right now we're the House Interim Committee on Revenue. It's our last one of this year and last scheduled one for this legislative assembly. I just want to say how much I've enjoyed being on this committee with each of you, and thank you all for your participation. And a couple of the members of this committee are not returning in the next legislative assembly, so a special goodbye and thanks to you, and thank you to the staff as well. Is there anything? Oh, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would echo what you said. I have a quick comment that's not on the agenda. It's not part of the conversation, but just wanted to get it out there for others on the committee and LRO to be aware that we passed House Bill 2270, which was the tobacco tax, which was passed by Oregonians in November. In that tax, there's a cigarette tax that has a floor tax. But for vaping products, there is no floor tax, but I hear the Department of Revenue is writing rules for a floor tax. And that is just, that's kind of troubling to me because that was not part of the legislation nor what the people voted for. So just kind of put a dot on that and then I'll bug out here and say, wish you a Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Are there any other comments before we end the meeting? Is there any other business to be done, Mr. Alanak?
I don't think so, Madam Chair. I think you've exhausted your agenda, as was once said.
Okay. Thank you all. We're adjourned.